The BBC presents My Word. Today's program, which comes from the Radcliffe Infirmary, situated on one of the busiest streets in Oxford, is introduced by Jack Longman.
My Word is a word game played by people whose business is words, and the teams taking part are, on my left, Miss Arnott Robertson and Frank Muir, and on my right, Miss Nancy Spain and Dennis Norton. And here's round one, which tests their vocabulary. What I do is to ask each member of the team in turn to explain the meaning of a word and a mark if they get it approximately right. Arnott Robertson, what is moraine? M-O-R-A-I-N-E, moraine.
Tomorrow's weather report.
It's the dirty bit in the middle of the glacier.
Yes.
The ass.
Well, it can be at the end, it can be at the side, but you're quite right. It's the bits of the mountain it scrapes off, and that's what a moraine is. Dennis Norton, what is shebeen?
Shebeen is an Irish word.
Yes.
Yes, it's a sort of... unofficial pub.
Quite right, it's an illegal pub, a house where excisable liquors are sold without a licence. Nancy Spain, what is a dottle?
A dottle is that thing that Frank keeps on trying to knock out of his pipe.
Yes.
It's a little small smouldering bit of burning tobacco or burnt tobacco.
And spit.
No, that's spittle.
Yes, I do.
No, that's not dottle, that's spittle.
Well, it's the bit at the bottom of the pipe that you don't normally smoke, and as you say, Frank knocks it out. Frank Muir, what's the meaning of panache?
Panache means, it's a sort of thing that you walk and behave with.
Yes.
It's a sort of dash and swagger, and is named after, of course, Beau Nash's father.
I accept the meaning. I unhesitatingly reject the derivation. It was probably first used in connection with Cyrano de Bergerac. But if you go back far enough, it really was a plume or tuft of feathers that you wore on your helmet or as a headdress, and from that it came to mean swagger.
The plume de ma tante at last. Isn't that nice?
Well, that brings us on to round two, which is names and places. And I want to know who or what the following ones were. Arnott Robertson, who was Apollyon? A-P-O-L-L-Y-O-N, Apollyon.
Isn't he an evil spirit of some kind? Isn't it another name for Lucifer? Or the original chap that did the trouble?
Yes, the devil. The king of the devils, the lord of the bottomless pit, is what he's called in the book of Revelations. And if you remember, Christian fought him in Pilgrim's Progress. Get your mark. And Dennis Norton, where is Pandemonium?
It's hell.
Yes.
And I believe it's where Apollyon used to work out what he was going to do.
Yes.
And all the other evil.
Well done, Dennis. Yes, it is the bottomless pit itself. It's the abode of the demons. It's the capital of hell, but the council of the devils. And it's very graphically described in that way by Milton in Paradise Lost. It comes to mean confusion, terrible, hopeless, noisy confusion. Nancy Spade, I want to know who was Natty Bumpo?
Fenimore Cooper, Deerstalker.
That's it. He's the hero of Fenimore Cooper's series of tales, the Leatherstocking Tales, and he was, in fact, you probably know him better by his other name, Natty Bumpo, he was, in fact, Hawkeye.
Hawkeye.
Yes. Yes, you get your mark. Frank Muir, if Hamlet was Prince of Denmark, who was Fortinbras?
He's a character in the play.
Yes,
Enter Fortinbras. He used to do battle in bronze armour. He was a prince.
Prince of, yes.
Yes, he definitely was a prince of, yes.
But I want to know what the country was, you get your mark.
It was a Scandinavian country.
Yes, it was.
A neighbouring Scandinavian country.
Good. Close as you like.
Norway, Sweden.
Yes.
Yes. Norway.
Fortinbras was
Norway.
Prince of Norway. Yes. Round three is very serious and difficult. It's all about literature. What I do is to give each member of the team a quotation, one or two lines, and ask them first to complete it, if they can, and afterwards to say where it comes from. Arnott Robertson, tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow.
Oh, that's the bard, the last syllable of recorded time. It's Macbeth.
Yes, it's Macbeth. Tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow creeps in this petty pace from day to day to the last syllable of recorded time. And all our yesterdays
have lighted pools
the way to dust it out, brief candle, and so on. Macbeth himself speaking in Macbeth Bagpipe. Dennis Norden. Lives of great men all remind us we can make ourselves sublime.
Yes, this is a favourite bit that they used to sew on samplers.
Yes.
Now, my embroidery is not what it was. lives of great men all remind us we can make our lives sublime. Da-da-da-da, leave behind us.
Yes.
Footprints in the sands of time.
On the sands of time.
On
Good.
The sands of time.
And author?
Longfellow.
Yes, Longfellow it is. Well done. Lives of great men all remind us we can make ourselves sublime and departing leave behind us and footprints on the sands of time. Longfellow's Psalm of Life. 2 marks. Nancy Spain. They spoke of progress spiring round, of light and Mrs. Humphrey Ward. It is not true to say I frowned or ran about the room and roared.
Well, I know it's by G.K. Chesterton.
Yes.
And I think it's called the something or other to do with Puritan.
Yes.
But how it goes on for the life of me.
In fact, it goes on. It is not true to say I frowned or ran about the room and roared. I might have simply sat and snored. I rose politely in the club and said, I feel a little bored. Will someone take me to a pub? G.K. Chesterton, ballad of, an anti-Puritan. Frank Muir. Far from the madding crowd's ignoble strife, their sober wishes never learn to stray.
Oh, yes, this is Canstoid Urn or Animated Bust.
Yes.
Perhaps some hairy-headed swine, you know. It's Gray's Elegy by Gray.
Yes.
Can you pump me off again?
Far from the madding crowd's ignoble strife, their sober wishes never learnt to stray.
Along the cool, sequestered vale of life, they walked the even tenor of their way.
Jolly good. They kept the noiseless tenor of their way. We'll go on to round four. This is about things which look similar but are different, and one mark for knowing the difference. Arnott Robertson, what's the difference between indigent and indigenous?
Indigence is hard up, and indigenous means growing where you are. Growing, starting in the country, belonging to the country, belonging to the place where you grow.
Indigent, needy or poor, indigenous, native or belonging to. 1 mark. Dennis Norden, the difference between cineraria and cinerarium. A and um. Cineraria and cinerarium.
Cinerarium.
Yes.
A cinerarium is a cinema where they show widescreen pictures. Whereas a cineraria isn't.
Terribly helpful and no marks at all so far.
I don't know either of these. Cinerarias.
Well,
is it a flower?
Yeah.
It was an herb.
No, it's a flower. It's a flower.
Which one's the flower?
One's a flower?
Cineraria is the flower. The cinerarium is the repository for the urns which have the ashes of the dead in them.
Egg timers, I thought.
Nancy Spain, I want to know the difference between a curé, with an accent acute on the E, and a curette. C-U-R-E-T-T-E.
Well, a curé is a sort of clergyman in France bicycling about with one of those berettas on.
Yes.
And a curette. Well, I think it's one of those things with like a spoon that you scrape with.
That's it, yes. Small instrument used by a surgeon for scraping, whereas the other is a parish priest in France, Catholic parish priest. 1 mark. Frank Muir, the difference between a eulogy and an elegy.
If you want to praise a man and say he looks very cheerful and festive and like a yule log, say that's a eulogy. Whereas if he dies from the shock and you then praise him rather fulsomely after he's dead, before he goes in the cinerarium, then that is an elegy.
Mm.
In other words, one's praising a dead man.
Yes.
And eulogies is really praising a live man.
Yes, I think that's good enough. It's a speech or writing in praise of a person. Elegy is a song of lamentation. It needn't necessarily praise him, Frank, but it normally does. All right, one more. Around five is about familiar expressions, though there's sometimes some hot dispute about this with members of the team. I want to know, first of all, meaning, and second, derivation, where the expression comes from, so you can possibly get 2 marks. Arnold Robertson, the phrase eavesdropper.
An eavesdropper is somebody who listens to what they shouldn't, and I suppose you did it by lying on the roof and putting your head down and being able to listen into the window, thus curving your body in a graceful arc under the eave.
Sounds dangerous. I
don't know. It's worth it, though.
I can't see any way by which otherwise listening to conversations which weren't intended for you could be connected with eaves.
Well, it needn't necessarily be on top of them.
Well, all right, you could be lying, you could be resting flat against the wall,
yes,
sheltered by the eave.
All right,
and
yes,
listening
all right
in at the window.
2 marks. It is a person who listens secretly and stealthily to somebody else's conversation. And the eavesdrop is rather nice. It was, or it's sometimes called the eavesdrip, was the space of ground that got the water running off your thatched or other roof. And the eavesdropper was therefore somebody who stood there probably pretty uncomfortably so that he could listen at the wall or beside the window to what was going on inside.
So you're jolly well right.
Dennis Norton, the phrase, like Caesar's wife.
Like Caesar's wife? It must be above suspicion.
Yes.
Caesar's wife, presumably, was in a position where she was not allowed to show interest in, not by so much of a twitch of the toga, in anybody else bar Julius.
Yes.
Yes.
I think. I think good enough. You've got it was Julius Caesar because it might have been one of many Caesars. The tale is that it was when his wife Pompeia was accused of having an intrigue with another chap called Clodius. Julius Caesar divorced his wife, Pompeia, not because he thought she was guilty, but because Caesar's wife must be above suspicion. Nancy Spain, the phrase, conscience money.
Conscience money? Well, it's what you pay all of a sudden for no reason at all, because you feel that you must have done something wrong sometime and taken the money away from someone else.
Yes.
You see it in the personal columns of the Times.
Yes, when it's getting you back to the origin. What is the origin?
Well, when you have a guilty conscience, you send some money.
It's the income tax, don't
it? To the income tax.
or, for example, if you sort of came down to Oxford for the BBC and you put in expenses for staying the night and you actually went back the same evening.
Then what do I do?
Well, then you'd return it to them in a plain envelope.
I think before we get any more terrible revelations, we'll give 2 marks straight away. It's money paid by somebody else in order to ease your conscience. And it does apparently come originally from this money being paid to the Inland Revenue or the Chancellor of the Exchequer by people who defrauded income tax authorities or who have said that their income was smaller than in fact it was. That's the first time the expression appears to have been used, and as Nancy Spain rightly suggested, if the Chancellor of the Exchequer does receive some unexpected gifts of this sort, he has to advertise the receipt in the London Gazette.
That's always interesting, isn't it? Because when you see these advertisements that he's received a fiver, you always get the feeling that the chap has actually done him out of about 80,000.
I think he gets the same feeling.
Yeah.
And Frankner, the phrase, post haste.
With all possible dispatch.
Yes.
It's usually in the connotation of travel, of movement.
Yes.
And one mark. And post haste from the post, from carrying the post.
And how did you carry the post?
How far back do you want?
I think it's on the right line.
Originally from horse to horse. In 12,
that's it.
12-mile legs, I believe.
That's it. It's when the post didn't go in these British railways ways, But the post was a number of individual horsemen posted along the route. I didn't know it was 12 miles apart, but Frank's probably quite right in it.
Well,
was.
If he tells you, it's right.
And it was especially good way at that time of taking urgent letters from one place to another, because when one horse got tired, you passed on to another one. And so on to round six. And round six is about writers' styles, and what I want each member of the team to do is to try and identify the author, and if they possibly can, the book too, from the bit that I'm going to read, the style of writing. Two marks if they get both the writer and the book it comes from, otherwise one for each half. Aunt Robertson, I never nursed a dear gazelle to glad me with its soft black eye, but when it came to know me well and love me, it was sure to marry a market gardener.
Hood.
No, it's not a bad shot, Aunt, but I don't think I've given you marks. The original was Thomas Moore, Lalo Rook, but the misquotation, that is, instead of ending up and love me, it was sure to die, but sure to marry a market gardener, is Dickens, the old curiosity shop, and it's Dick Swiveller speaking. Dennis Norden, I went out to Charing Cross to see Major General Harrison hanged, drawn, and quartered, which was done there, he looking as cheerful as any man could do in that condition.
Non-fiction? Did he go out to Charing Cross?
Yes, non-fiction.
Yeah. Well, a diarist.
Yes, diarist.
Well, one says Pepys.
Pepys it is. And now Nancy's bed. We often discover what will do by finding out what will not do. And probably he who never made a mistake never made a discovery.
Oh, dear, it's deep philosophical stuff, isn't it?
No, not at all. It's all in the family.
Mrs. Beaton?
No, wrong one.
Samuel Smiles?
Yes.
Self-help?
Yes. Frank Muir, consider what a great girl you are. Consider what a long...
You're really at me tonight, Jack. Really.
Consider what a long way you've come today. Consider what a clock it is. Consider anything. Only don't cry.
Consider what a clock it is. Is it one of my relations? Consider what a great girl you are. Is it Alice?
Yes, it is.
Well, there we are. It's Alice.
In?
In the rabbit hole.
Alice, wrong book.
Alice Through.
Alice Through.
Alice Through the Looking Glass.
Charles Lutwidge Dodson, Lewis Carroll, Alice Through the Looking Glass. And so we come to the last round, which is a bit complicated. I give two quotations, and I ask Arnold Robertson to identify one and Nancy Spain to identify the other. And while they're doing that, or trying to do it, I invite Frank Muir and Dennis Norden to think of a situation to which the words might originally have applied. So one mark for each correct answer from Nancy and Arnott, and a mark to either Dennis Norden or Frank Muir to be awarded by you, the audience. Now we begin tonight with Nancy Spain, and the phrase is, all is lost except honour.
Well, it was a battle of some sort.
Yes.
Probably a very famous battle.
Unsuccessful battle, but some.
Well, it was probably said in some foreign language.
It was?
By the defeated.
Yes.
Tu es perdu, mais seulement l'honneur.
Sauf
l'honneur.
Force l'honneur.
Force l'honneur.
F-O-R.
Yes. Well, in that case, it would obviously be...
French. I remember we were mustered at Cressy.
It's one of those very foreign wars that the French fought.
Yes. It was Francis I of France in a letter to his mother on the morning after the disastrous Battle of Pavia.
Pavia? And,
yes. What he really said was, in fact, not all is lost except honour, but nothing remains to me save honour and life, which was not quite so gallant. And now, Arnott Robertson, the phrase, from the sublime to the ridiculous.
Well, now, that's the kind of thing that's also said in wars, and I never can remember whether things were said by Napoleon or by Wellington, because from fighting against one another so much, they talked extraordinarily alike.
Well, have a go.
They wore the same hat, too. One was one way
and the boots. The boots were the same.
Napoleon.
Napoleon it was.
Ah.
Napoleon, on his return from Russia after the disastrous retreat from Moscow, which was a descent from the sublime to the ridiculous, to a chap whom I've never heard of before called the Abbé Duprat. And now, Dennis Norden, what really happened when the phrase "all is lost except honour" originated?
All is lost except honour brings back the very first job I had when I left school. I took a job for which I was really physically quite unsuited. Chambermaid. not in a hotel. It was at the Chamber of Horrors at a distinguished waxworks in London called Madame Tussauds. And my job was dusting the effigies and waxworks in the Chamber of Horrors. I wasn't happy, and I went to Madame Tussauds, and I explained that I wasn't happy, and she said, "What would you like to do?" And I said, "I'd like to do something more creative." I'd always been that sort of person, you know. And she said, "Well, would you like to go into the department where they actually make the waxworks?" Well, this sounded jolly interesting, you know, so I said yes, and I went. And I went to this department where they put the hair on the heads of the models. You know, these people there are called, they have a very strange nomenclature, they're called hair put-oners. and every hair on all these models is put on individually. Did you know that? Do you know, and this immediately I saw it, the expertise, the craftsmanship fascinated me, and I plumped this. I said, "This is what I'd like to do." And so they handed me a model. They said, "We've got a new model coming in to the Hall of Great Literary People," and it was a model of Elizabeth Barrett Browning. And she was completely bald, you see, waiting for the hair to be put on, and they said, "Well, there you are, put hair on that." And I looked at this model of Elizabeth Barrett Browning, and I thought, "There's only one thing for you. We've got to soften you up." So I switched on the electric fire, and I laid her down very gently in front of the fire, and I went out for a cup of tea. And then I met a great pal of mine there, and he said, "There's a good film. Anyway, I got back about 11:30, and there was Liz. And it really was rather awful. She'd been left there much too long. And everything was dissolved into sort of liquid from this heat, you see. And I knew I'd had it. I knew this job wasn't for me at that moment. But I had to explain to Madam, and I couldn't dare face her, and I had to think of a telegram in which to tell her that her precious Elizabeth Browning had completely melted, and I was no longer in her employ. So I sent this telegram, which, as I say, reminded me of this phrase, and the telegram said, "All Liz lost, ex hair put on her."
Well, that was Chamber of Horrors, wasn't it? And now, for Frank Muir, the phrase "from the sublime to the ridiculous."
My story is rather different. It's just a bald statement of fact. it concerns gardening. When we moved into our house, there was a lot of grass, which is that green stuff, you know, and some trees, which are also green, but on the end of a pole. And my wife particularly wanted a flower bed. And I thought I'd rather go into this, you know. I saw myself as a horny-headed son of toil, you know. And I read up on the subject beforehand because I wanted to do it properly. So I went to a gardening shop and I inquired there about compost and various, asking your pardon, manures. And he... They're apparently, because this composting business, you know, and people make a fetish of it. It has to be, everything has to be organic, and they go mad. There's sort of non-compost mentis about it. But the chap put me straight, this fellow in the shop. He said, "No, you use lime, but not ordinary lime. We have a special, it's all bagged up, and it's very clean to handle and friable, and it's called super lime, and it contains hyperphosphates and essential minerals." And I took it home, bore it home, and read all these weird things it had in it. And I found from my gardening book that before applying my super lime, I had to dig the flower bed a spit deep. It's a puzzling phrase, you know, when you first come across it. I mean, how deep? I mean, how? I finally realised what it was, of course. And I there's an old inn in the village, and they've got a spit above the fireplace, and I measured it, and it was about 5'6". So I dug the flower bed over to a depth of 5'6", you see. And then I spread my super lime all over that. The next thing was to hoe the surface and prepare it for the seed bed. So having hoed, I planted out bedding plants, which I'd bought at great expense, and I planted them very carefully with a dibbler. And the seeds, I used a drill, which is the pepper thing. I used a quarter-inch drill. It took a tremendous length of flex back to the house. But I did want to do it properly, and I measured out all the little seeds and put them in. And we sat back and waited. And, you know, you should see that flower bed today. It is one glorious mass of colour. Brown. I don't know why. I mean, I planted it the full 5 feet down, but nothing had come up at all, except one thing, actually. My small son wanted to get in on this gardening. He bought a threepenny packet of ranunculus seeds, and he planted it, seed packet and all, and there was this beautiful bunch, glorious bunch of ranunculus. And that, I'm afraid, is the complete story of my flower bed. From the super lime to the ranunculus.
Well, I think Frank Miller gets home on that story by a very short head. And that brings us to a final score in which the two teams are only one mark apart. Very close indeed. And Nancy Spain and Dennis Norden win with that one mark ahead, and Arnott Robertson and Frank Miller one mark less.
He's second.
Second.
In My Word, you heard E. Arnott Robertson, Nancy Spain, Frank Muir and Dennis Norden, introduced by Jack Longman. The program, which came from the Radcliffe Infirmary, Oxford, was devised by Tony Schryan and Edward J. Mason and presented by the BBC. ¶¶